Well, welcome. I'm Chris Sharon. This is the sixth in a series of seven sessions that started last week and continues this week, engaging what I call my white story. It's actually three stories. It's the story of Laura Ingalls Wilder and her family, which is my family story. So it's also a reflection on my story and how I think back across the generations of my family. My great-grandmother was Laura's double cousin, Lottie, and Laura were born in 1867 in Pepin, Wisconsin, and they grew up together there. Some of their stories are recounted in the first book in the series, Little House in the Big Woods. And then later on, they reconnected, their families reconnected in the book that we're talking about today, By the Shores of Silver Lake, which takes place in Desmet, South Dakota. And my family, Lottie and her parents, Henry and Polly, kept going out to Keystone, South Dakota. And then even further, Lottie, after she married my great-grandfather, and had my grandmother, May, in Keystone, they moved on out to Wyoming, which is where my dad was born and grew up. So I'm telling in this series stories about the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, Little House on the Prairie, but also my own story as it intertwines with that story. And I'm doing that at a particular time in the United States, and I want to say a little bit more about that in a minute. But here's a picture of my great-grandma Charlotte on the far right. And I don't know if you can see the resemblance or not, but if you look at Laura's face and you look at Charlotte's face, there's a little similarity. But what's really funny is my sister, Anne Marie, looks exactly like Charlotte. It's funny how family resemblance passes down. And today we're talking about Desmet, and we're going to, among other things, look at the promotional video, or basically the Welcome Center video. At Desmet that they used to introduce people to the site. And in 2008, when my family was in between our home in Connecticut and relocating to St. Paul, Minnesota, we came to Holden for the summer, kind of as like leaving therapy, because every day you go out to the bus and you wave, every day you welcome people, so you sort of get over your sense of loss by greeting people and saying goodbye to people every day. But on the way, we drove across the country, and on the way, we stopped at all the Laura Ingalls Wilder sites. We stopped at Pepin, Wisconsin, and went to the log cabin in the woods. And we stopped in Walnut Grove, which originally was Walnut Station, because it was a town plotted along the railway as the railway was built west, and visited all the sites there. And then we stopped in Desmet, which also was a town built on the railway line as it went west, and visited the visitor center there, the sod hut, and the home, went out to the where their homestead was, and their house in town and all that. And how many of you have done that?
What town was that?
Desmet, South Dakota. That's where they ended up. One, two, three. Few of you have done some of those site visits. Desmet is where Caroline and Charles, Pa and Ma Ingalls, are buried, and some of the children, not all of them. So those two stories are important. And the third story I suggested that gives me the motivation to do this project now versus other things I could do research about and write on is what's happening in our country right now. And there's a book called The End of White Christian America by Robert Jones, which I've been drawing upon. He's a survey researcher at the intersection of religion and politics in Washington. And he wrote the book talking about a demographic transition in our nation right now and the way that it's producing tensions in our country. And he says that one of the responses of white people, white Christians especially, which is the dominant percentage of white people in the country are Christian, is one major response of that demographic is anxiety and nostalgia. Nostalgia about a past when things were simpler in a sense because we, as white people, were dominant. It was less complicated what place we had in society. And so nostalgia and anxiety about our circumstance now, especially for working class, sort of laboring, the sort of union demographic, the folks whose manufacturing jobs have moved to China or Mexico, that have been automated by the introduction of robotic technology. So there's a whole set of dynamics which are creating anxiety about where we are now. And he says in this book, The End of White Christian America, that some of these dynamics are coalescing groups of the white population which haven't historically come together. And they came together in large part around Donald Trump's candidacy for president. And one of the outcomes of that is a kind of coming out into the public, a resurgence of white nationalism and white supremacy, and a whole spectrum of groups which represent that perspective. This is a picture from the march and protest in Charlottesville over the weekend. And you can see them very clearly showing up in a militarized sort of riot gear style. And they've planned 9 marches across the country for this coming Saturday. Whoa. Atlanta, Los Angeles, Pittsburgh, Seattle, New York, Washington, Austin, Texas, Boston, and Mountain View, California. Why Mountain View, California? Because they're protesting Google's firing of one of its employees for writing a public anti-diversity manifesto, which Google as an organization stands strongly against, that kind of viewpoint. Their firing of him was, in a sense, because his stated public view went explicitly against their corporate policy. But these groups are organizing these protests across the country against his firing and in a sense for his position against diversity. So you can see this is kind of in a sense the extreme end of that nostalgia and anxiety asserting itself. In the march on Saturday, they were saying, "You will not take our place. Jews will not take our place. Blood and soil." You know, these mantras that asserted a very direct claim about white dominance. So in the context of what's happening in our country, I've taken to heart the suggestion from friends of mine, especially people of color, who say white people need to not assume their story as a universal story, a mythological story, but actually tell their story in particular ways that are more truthful, more complex, that admit the violence that is underneath our prosperity, whatever prosperity we have, the violence that's underneath that, the violence that's underneath our historic dominance in this country. And if we're going to make this transition as a country from majority white to minority, to the white population being the minority, in a way that's at all just and generous, we white people have to learn how to be participants at the table, to take a seat at the table of our nation, rather than being the ones who determine who gets and who does not get a seat at the table, which has been the historic position that we've taken. So my own taking on of this project at this moment is similar to, there's a book, Hillbilly Elegy, which is a similar journey. There's another book I'm drawing on today called Encounter on the Great Plains by Karen Hansen, which is, as I'll say a little bit more about, her own investigation of her great-grandparents getting a pioneer site, a homestead site in North Dakota, on an Indian reservation. How did it happen that her grandmother homesteaded on an Indian reservation, a Dakota reservation? So I'll go into that a little bit more later. So telling these These white stories are something all of us can do. Something I think all of us, from a moral perspective, ought to do, in the sense that it helps us be more honest about our own story, and the moral complicity that we have in our current situation, and hopefully from that some humility about how we go forwards. In a sense, stepping back from assumptions about our role in our country and asking afresh, how do we enter into a more diverse, pluralistic society in which we share power with many groups, with groups as diverse as our interfaith panel and much, much more. So that's the context of doing the work that I'm doing this week in this series. In the last session, tomorrow is called Brown is the New White. And it's really, at the end of this series, an effort to try and depict in a much more interactive, less presentation and a more interactive way, in envisioning together what is the country that we want to live in. One of my colleagues, Sister Simone Campbell, went to the, she's a leader of the Network, which is a Roman Catholic nuns lobby in Washington around poverty issues. And she does the Nuns on the Bus tour. Anyone heard of that? So Sister Simone's awesome. And she went to the Republican National Convention and she had, those little red wagons? She had little red wagons with she and her friends, her sister friends, and big coolers of lemonade. And they passed. They couldn't get into the convention center, but they circulated outside, and they handed out lemonade, making lemons into lemonade. It's kind of an inside joke for her. They handed out lemonade, and they said, "What kind of country are you dreaming of? What kind of future do you hope for?" And then listened. And she could have gone there and stood on her soapbox and harangued them about the terrible consequences of Republican policies, the Republican platform, and so forth. But instead, she tried to find common ground in listening to their dream of the future. Well, that's what I want to do together with you, ask that question. What kind of future do you dream of? What kind of country could we be in 20 years, 30 years, when we're majority-minority as a country? Whoops, I'm pressing myself backwards. So today's session, by the shores of Silver Lake, takes place in the sequence of the Ingalls family's life after they've left the Big Woods, gone to Kansas. They have a crazy itinerary in their life. They went, I think, like 1,500 miles, all told, across, back and forth across the Midwest, moving different places before they ended up in DeShmet. But this, in part, was because of the difficulties. One of the aspects of telling this story is being honest about the fact that the pioneers weren't just stealing land and resources from the native peoples. That's not the only part of the story. Another part of the story is a kind of heroic survival. Boy, terrible circumstances that they subsisted in. And in some cases, especially with the immigrants who didn't speak English, they were treated by the settlers who had been there longer as a negative influence in a different way than the native population, but also treated very badly. That's the case in this story, Encounter on the Great Plains, about the Norwegian immigrants who settled on this Devil's Lake Reservation in North Dakota. So it's a complicated story, but they had moved back and forth partly because they didn't succeed. They were having a really difficult time. They were in Walnut Creek before they moved to South Dakota, and they'd moved to Walnut Creek just as a huge locust or grasshopper infestation landed in that part of the country. And multiple years, their entire wheat crop was eaten just before harvest. By the grasshoppers, and they had no means to survive, and they didn't know what to do. And I'm going to pick up the story here and just read this that gives you Laura's depiction of their decision to move west. Where I'm going today is to talk about two specific pieces of legislation which are background for this period of time. One is the Homestead Act, very important to make sense of, and it's a part of this this specific story and their homesteading in Deschmet. But also the Dawes Act, which is much less known, and was, in a sense, the shift in government policy from literally the extermination, the extermination of Native peoples and expulsion of them from the land, to their assimilation. But assimilation not on their own terms, but by culturally co-opting them into being model U.S. citizens, by de-Indianifying them. The phrase was, "Don't kill the man, kill the Indian, but don't kill the man." And the Dawes Act was the turning point in that process. And so, going into that a little bit, I think points towards what happened after after these books were written, and set up a number of pieces of the story, including the terrible story of the boarding schools.
The Homestead Act covered what period of time?
I'm going to give you a slide that gives the details of it in just a second, but it was passed in 1862. So the same year, interestingly, that the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. And it was delayed. It had been proposed in the 40s. It was delayed in Congress because they did not want African American or Native people allowed to claim sections of land. They wanted it for whites only. Well, here's the beginning of the story. Laura was washing dishes one morning when old Jack, their dog, lying in the sunshine on the doorstep, growled to tell her someone was coming. She looked out and saw a buggy crossing the gravelly ford of Plum Creek. "Ma," she said, "it's a strange woman coming." Ma sighed. She was ashamed of the untidy house, and so was Laura. But Ma was too weak and Laura too tired, and they were too sad to care very much. Mary and Carrie and baby Grace and Ma had all had scarlet fever. The Nelsons across the creek had had it too, so there had been no one to help Pa and Laura. The doctor had come every day. Pa did not know how he could pay the bill. Far worse of all, the fever had settled in Mary's eyes, and Mary was blind. She was able to sit up now, wrapped in quilts in Ma's old hickory rocking chair. All that long time, week after week, when she could still see little but less every day, she had never cried. Now she could not even see the brightest light anymore. Still, she was patient and brave. Her beautiful golden hair was gone. Pa had shaved it close because of the fever, and her poor shorn head looked like a boy's. Her blue eyes were still beautiful, but they did not know what was before them, and Mary herself could never look out through them again to tell Laura what she was thinking without saying a word. Who can it be this hour of the morning, Mary wondered, turning her ear toward the sound of the buggy. It's a strange woman alone in a buggy. She's wearing a brown sunbonnet and driving a bay horse, Laura answered. Pa had said that she must be eyes for Mary. Can you think of anything for dinner? Ma asked. She meant for a company dinner, if the woman stayed until dinner time. There was bread and molasses and potatoes. That was all. This was springtime, too early for garden vegetables. The cow was dry, and the hens had not begun to lay their summer's eggs. Only a few small fish were left in Plum Creek. Even the cottontail rabbits had been hunted until they were scarce. Pa did not like a country so old and worn out that the hunting was poor. He wanted to go west. For 2 years he had wanted to go west and take a homestead, but Ma did not want to leave the settled country. And there was no money. Pa had made only two poor wheat crops since the grasshoppers came. He had barely been able to keep out of debt, and now there was the doctor's bill. Laura answered Ma stoutly, "What's good enough for us is good enough for anybody." The buggy stopped and a strange woman sat in it, looking at Laura and Ma in the doorway. She was a pretty woman in her neat brown print dress and sunbonnet. Laura felt ashamed of her own bare feet and limp dress and uncombed braids. Then Ma said slowly, "Why, Dosha!" "I wondered if you'd know me," the woman said. "A good deal of water has gone under the bridge since you folks left Wisconsin." She was pretty Aunt Dosha, who had worn the dress with buttons that looked like blackberries long ago at the sugaring off dance at Grandpa's house in the big woods of Wisconsin. She was married now. She had married a widower with two children. Her husband was a contractor working on the new railroad in the West. Aunt Dosha was driving alone in the buggy all the way from Wisconsin to the railroad camps in Dakota Territory. She had come by to see if Pa would go with her. Her husband, Uncle High, wanted a good man to be the storekeeper, bookkeeper, and timekeeper, and Pa could have the job. "It pays $50 a month, Charles," she said. A kind of tightness smoothed out of Pa's thin cheeks, and his blue eyes lit up. He said slowly, "It seems like I can draw a good pay while I'm looking for that homestead, Caroline." Ma still did not want to go west. She looked around the kitchen at Carrie and Laura standing and Grace with Grace in her arms. "Charles, I don't know," she said. "It does seem providential, $50 a month." So this is just jumping ahead to now as they're arriving close to DeSchmidt together. All the little sounds of the blowing grasses and of the horses munching and whooshing in their feed box at the back of the wagon, and even the sounds of eating and talking, could not touch the enormous silence of this prairie. Pa talked about his new job. He would be the company storekeeper and the timekeeper at Silver Lake Camp. He would run the store, and he would keep straight in his books the charge account of every man on the job and know exactly how much money was due each man for his work after his board bill and his account at the store had been subtracted. And when the paymaster brought the money each payday, Pa would pay every man. That was all he had to do, and for that he would be paid $50 every month. "And best of all, Caroline, we're among the very first out here," said Pa. "We've got the pick of the land for our homestead. By George, our luck has turned at last. First chance at new land and $50 a month for the whole summer to boot." "It is wonderful, Charles," said Ma. But all their talking did not mean anything to the enormous silence of that prairie. All that afternoon they went on, mile after mile, never seeing a house or any sign of people, never seeing anything but grass and sky. The trail they followed was marked only by bent and broken grasses. Laura saw old Indian trails and buffalo paths worn deep in the ground and now grassed over. She saw large, strange depressions, straight-sided and flat-bottomed, that had been buffalo wallows where there was now grass growing. Laura had never seen a buffalo, and Pa said it was not likely she ever would see one. Only a little while before, the vast herds of thousands of buffaloes had grazed over this country. They had been the Indians' cattle, and white men had slaughtered them all. On every side now, the prairie stretched away empty to far, clear skyline. The wind never stopped blowing, waving the tall prairie grasses that had turned brown in the sun. And all afternoon, while Pa kept driving onward, he was merrily whistling or singing. The song he sang oftenest was, "Oh, come to this country and don't you feel alarm, for Uncle Sam is rich enough to give us all a farm." Even baby Grace joined in the chorus, though she did not bother to follow the tune. "Oh, come away, come away, come away, I say. Oh, come away, come away, oh, come right away. Oh, come to this country and have no fear of harm. Our Uncle Sam is rich enough to give us all a farm." The Homestead Act was the basis of their capacity to go to Dakota Territory and claim a section. And the basic principle of the Homestead Act was could be a man or a woman, they intentionally put that into the law, who had never fought against the United States. So there was an explicit, I think, punishment of the South built into it. But it was prioritizing immigrants and trying to encourage the settlement of this new territory that they had wrested from the Indians and purchased from France, and all different ways of explaining that. And the basic principle was, for a quarter section of land, 160 acres, you had to stake a claim and, quote, improve the land by cultivating it and live on it for 5 years. And so then for a filing fee of $14, you could take title of that land. And this whole policy was in a sense a rebuke of the South, because it really lifted up this idea, the kind of New England ideal of the single individual who has a farm on which you grow what you need to survive, against the image in the South of a landowner with vast property that was farmed by slaves. So built into it is a particular understanding of America and what makes America the country it is. This the individual can-do, entrepreneurial, sort of single-handed, pull yourself up by your bootstraps vision, and being close to the land, fending for yourself and growing what you need on your land. And the Schmet was, the railroad ran right through central South Dakota at that point, and it's just across the border in central South Dakota, if you don't know where it is. And one of the threads that I think is really important to see in this is the particular intersection of the time these books were written and the relationship between Laura and her daughter, Rose, who was absolutely essential to their emerging as a series of books in the first place. Rose was Laura's only daughter, and she was a journalist and traveled around. She lived quite an interesting life, living in Europe and across the U.S. And she drew on her mother's stories and her own memories for writing some of her short stories. And both she and her mother had a sort of gut reaction to the Great Depression and to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal initiatives in the 1930s. And that reaction was negative. This is a description of their view. It's not a quote from them. At a time when President Franklin D. Roosevelt was introducing the major federal initiatives of the New Deal and Social Security as a way out of the Depression, the Little House books lulled children to sleep with the opposite message. The books placed self-reliance at the heart of the American myth. If the pioneers wanted a farm, they found one. If they needed food, they killed it or grew it. If they needed shelter, they built it. And this is one among many places where that view is in here. And this is the editorial edition of Rose. Laura, the way they worked was Laura would write vignettes from her childhood, and she would give them to Rose, and Rose would put them together into the shape of the novel, and she would add her editorial gloss. And her editorial gloss was always to take the hardship and turn it towards this sort of hardscrabble optimism that if one works hard enough and has a vision for what they want to do, they can accomplish it. And this is the description of the railroad and Pa's view about what was being built in De Schmet in conversation with Laura. First, someone, this is an example of Rose's editorial voice in the novels. First, someone thought of a railroad. Then the surveyors had come to mark out that empty country. Again and again, you hear that rhetoric of the empty country. The surveyors had come out to that empty country, and they had marked and measured a railroad that was not there at all. And then it was only a railroad that someone had thought of. Then the plowmen came to tear up the prairie grass, and the scrapermen to dig up the dirt, and the team masters with their wagons to haul it. And all of them said they were working on the railroad, but still the railroad wasn't there. Nothing was there yet but cuts through the prairie swells, pieces of the railroad grade that were really only narrow, short ridges of earth, all pointing westward across the enormous grassy land. When the grade's finished, Pa said, the shovelmen will come along with hand shovels, and they'll smooth the sides of the grade by hand and level it on top. And then they'll lay the rails, Laura said. Don't jump ahead so fast, Flutterbudget, Pa laughed at her. The railroad ties have got to be shipped out here and laid before it's time for the rails. Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither is a railroad or anything else worth having. The sun was so low now that each prairie swell began to have its shadow lying eastward, and out of the large, pale sky, flocks of ducks and along the wedges of geese were sliding down Silver Lake to rest for the night. The clean wind was blowing now with no dust in it, and Laura let her sunbonnet slip down her back so she could feel the wind on her face and see the whole great prairie. There was no railroad now, but someday long steel tracks would lie level on the fills and through the cuts, and trains would come roaring, steaming, and smoking with speed. The tracks and the trains were not there now, but Laura could see them almost as if they were there. Suddenly she asked, "Pa, was that what made the very first railroad?" "What are you talking about?" Pa asked. "Are the railroads because people think of them first when they aren't there?" Pa thought a minute. "That's right," he said. "Yes, that's what makes things happen. People think of them first. If enough people think of a thing and work hard enough at it, I guess it's pretty nearly bound to happen, wind and weather permitting." So, at the time of the first novels publishing in 1930, this relationship was building between Rose and Laura. And as the success of the series took off and they continued this, this is now book number 5 in the series. And books 5, 6, and 7, published in the late 30s and early 40s, increasingly took on this anti-New Deal, anti-government voice and pro-individual self-determination. And you can hear at certain points real negative views of the government. If the government gives you something which enhances your freedom, expands your personal freedom, government is good. If government regulates you or causes you trouble in following your free expression, then government is bad. And one of the arguments in this book, Little House, Long Shadow, is that the view, the sort of view of government and of individual entrepreneurial work really set up a particular way of understanding the government and the way of understanding the United States that fit right into the particular rise of a conservatism in our country. What Ronald Reagan, for example, a kind of optimism and can-do spirit, and what will make us great again as a nation is if we can reduce the size of government, get government out of people's lives, and let people take charge of their own lives. So that rhetoric is really present in the books. And interestingly, Rose became the sole heir to the Enterprise, and she became one of the founding mothers of the Libertarian Party. And the entire Enterprise of the Little House on the Prairie books became property of this guy named LeBray, who was one of the founders of the Libertarian Party and even ran for president under the Libertarian banner. And so that ideology that is a part of the framing of the story, the myth of the rugged pioneer, had an actual literal trajectory into American politics by funding one of the political parties that is still operating in the U.S. Well, what I want to do now is get into some conversation with you about what you're seeing in this angle on the stories about a particular interpretation of the myth of American pioneer experience by showing you the welcome video from De Smet. Pretend you're stopping in De Smet at the home site and you're viewing this video, but you've just had this conversation with me about some of the dynamics that are a part of the background of writing the stories and the background of the actual circumstances of the land, that this this Homestead Act, which came about right along the same period of time as the Dakota were through treaties and through the 1862 war, were pushed out of Minnesota and out of most of the Dakotas onto reservations, and so this land was available. Bringing that set of issues, then watch this video and just notice what it highlights, the language that it uses, and what you might expect to hear something about, but don't.
Welcome to the Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie. Here on this land, the hopes and dreams of the Charles Ingalls family came true. We hope to help you enjoy the wonder of this prairie while learning about homesteading. When Congress passed the Homestead Act of 1862, land fever spread like a prairie fire. Hopeful settlers from many different parts of the world looked upon the vast sea of prairie grass rippling in the wind and yearned to claim a piece of this free land and make it their own. Charles and Caroline Ingalls and their two daughters, Mary and Laura, lived in the big woods of Wisconsin near Pepin. Charles was stricken with a serious case of land fever. Before he found a cure, his family traveled by covered wagon over 1,550 miles to the little house on the prairie near Independence, Kansas, to the banks of Plum Creek in Minnesota, to Burr Oak, Iowa, back to Walnut Grove, and finally here to Dakota Territory on Ingalls Homestead near the little town on the prairie. Pa sang a popular song of the era, "Uncle Sam is rich enough to give us all a farm."
Oh, come to this country and have no fear of harm. Our Uncle Sam is rich enough to give us all a farm.
In the summer of 1879, Pa, as Laura called him, came to this man working on the railroad. His girls, Ma, Mary, Laura, Carrie, and Grace, met him in the fall. They spent their first winter in the surveyor's shanty on the shores of Silver Lake. In February 1880, Pa picked this quarter section of land to be their homestead. Pa thought it was right in every way. It was located near the town site, so the girls could walk to school. It had upland for hay and good farm ground. It was next to the big slough, where Pa could harvest hay in a dry year. Pa met the homestead requirements since he was over 21 years of age, farmed over 10 acres, and built a little shanty that would be their home over the next 5 years. Charles and Caroline made good on their bet with Uncle Sam. In 1886, proof papers were filed and published. For a mere $16 in filing fees, this 160-acre farm became theirs. Your stop at Ingalls Homestead is a prairie visit. See, touch, hear, smell, and feel Laura's prairie come to life. On the covered wagon ride, children are given the opportunity to drive the gentle team of horses. Appreciate the simplicity of education in the one-room little prairie school. Take a walk through the native prairie grass. Try hay twisting, rope making, wheat grinding, and other hands-on activities. Step into the cool dampness of the dugout. Feel the confinement of the Burby shanty. Gain an understanding of the 1880s homestead way of life. DeSmet proudly accepts the honor of sharing Laura's little town on the prairie with our visitors. Ingalls Homestead, Laura Ingalls Wilder Memorial Society, Laura Ingalls Wilder Pageant Society, the Loftus Store, Depot Museum, and all the people and businesses of DeSmet enjoy presenting this heritage. Other points of interest to visit include Almanzo Wilder's homestead site, DeSmet Cemetery with grave sites of Charles, Caroline, Mary, Carrie, Grace, and baby boy Wilder, the Big Slough, Silver Lake, the City Library, the Father DeSmet statue at Washington Park, and Lake Thompson Recreation Area. Facing the many struggles of rugged homestead pioneer life, Pa, Ma, and the girls knew family was the most important thing in the world. We all cherish the memories that Laura captured in her little house books. We hope your family also captures memories to be cherished. An easy-to-follow homestead map makes it possible to venture at your own pace. Relax and enjoy your prairie visit to Ingalls Homestead.
So I just invite reactions, things you that struck you as you listened to the invitation to come to DeSmet and learn the stories and enjoy the sights.
It's like the Disneyland.
Disneyland of the Prairie. Yeah.
Why do we want to go back to the 1950s? Why don't we want to go back to that? It makes it look so idyllic.
It does. It makes it look idyllic. Yeah. which fits the Disneyland description. It's a
whitewashed version.
A whitewashed version, yeah. Yeah, over here.
Did you not have to be a U.S. citizen? Immigrants, so
you did not have to be
a white immigrant. You could,
if you were a white immigrant intending to become a naturalized citizen, then you qualified for the Homestead Act, okay. Which is how they could market it to new immigrants. Yeah, but that was one of the clear legal ways of ruling out native peoples because they couldn't be citizens. So that's. That sets up what I'm going to turn to in a few minutes, which is why the Dawes Act was made. Yeah.
Because there was no mention of the natives.
No, there's no mention of the natives. That's right, in any way.
How recent is that video?
I don't know.
There was a
transition or change or recognition of the native populations that were around.
Yeah. There wasn't when we went, as I mentioned, we went in 2008, so that's 10 years ago. But my understanding is this video is the video that they show at the visitor center to welcome guests. So, what else did you notice? Anything about the language or the yeah?
I thought it was odd that they used Irish music.
I
just this morning finished reading Dear Aunt Eve of Jesus.
Uh-huh.
You read that?
No.
It's a story of the Scotch Irish and the Calvinist influence on the working class in America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's a different telling of a similar story.
Yeah.
And their kind of anti-government tendencies.
Yeah. Well, a couple things about that. One, Pa was quite a musician and just loved all sorts of music that was popular in the 19th century. But also, his family was from Lincolnshire in England, and Caroline's family was from the Isle of Man. And so they had heritage that would take them back to both Celtic and English lands. So it would make sense that they would have some of that affinity in the musical taste that they had. Yeah, up here. Yeah, Sonia.
So I find it interesting that they call out so directly their tie to family values.
Yes.
I mean, that just seems like, it almost seems like Rose is just editing it right over the storyline to say, just in case you didn't notice, this is where we land politically, because the words are so loaded.
Yeah, and the family values have a kind of, what would I say, there's a kind of amnesia about the morality that they're concerned about. Like, they're concerned about, for instance, Ma's always telling Laura to keep her bonnet on. Why? Because women define themselves over against African Americans and Native women by their whiteness. There was a kind of purity to their skin, which if you had your bonnet off, then your skin would turn brown, like the Indians. So this kind of civilizing set of manners, you know, not interrupting your parents, you know, eating properly, all these kind of manners, but then this deeper, profoundly immoral thing that was going on is just not even, or hardly ever mentioned. Yeah, yeah.
But that skin color was not from America. That came over from England. And if you were a lady.
Exactly.
Not a working class.
Right.
So this was really not an Indian, this was not a immigrant, I mean, Indian,
it was
native thing. This was to be a lady.
That's right. It goes way back to European class distinctions. Absolutely.
Right. And so I don't think we can really put that particular thing.
No, but they transfigured that European sensibility about class divisions and manners to the context they were in on the prairie, and instead of class difference, it became race difference. And the Native American people were the people they didn't want to be in this context. But absolutely, there's a really powerful book by Norbert Elias called The Civilizing Process, which traces the sort of development of manners in the European West for exactly what you're pointing to, class distinctions and power. And how those function to sort of separate people in a hierarchical sort of way. Yeah.
I was struck by the term free land, and I think
right.
I personally have had an aha moment. Oh, yeah. free land, except it wasn't free. So how did it become free? How did the government have the right to give this land? And, you know, those are the questions that I think you're provoked by, and
yeah.
I've become provoked by also. But in the video, that's free land.
Goes back to the doctrine of discovery.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And there's an underlying narrative about the disappearance of the native peoples in the books, and the emptiness of the land. That rhetoric of the emptiness of the land comes up again and again, and that was it was intentional in the policies of the U.S. government, that first the Native Americans would be removed, then exterminated, and then acculturated. So that three-part move was intended to make them disappear, literally. That there's a young Sioux hip-hop artist named Frank Wallen, who I really encourage you to check out. And he got a scholarship from his home in South Dakota to go to college in Chicago. And when he got there, he literally had people say to him, "Oh, I didn't know your people were still here." Like, he literally had people surprised that he was coming from an actual living tribe in South Dakota. And he ended up dropping out and becoming a musical artist, because it gives him a platform for a political protest about Native issues. So he's what I call conscious hip-hop, or political hip-hop, in powerful, powerful songs about the Native experience today. And it's directly related to these same issues that we're talking about. Well, let me say a few words about, before we finish, about the Dawes Act and what happened. Here's Senator Henry Dawes from Massachusetts. Interestingly, a senator from Massachusetts comes up with this. And so it was passed in 1887, and it gave Native land to civilize them as farmers and ranchers. What they did was they took, so a couple of things happened. There were enough immigrants coming since 1862, when the Homestead Act was passed, that much of the available land had already been homesteaded, and there were more immigrants coming. In fact, Norwegian immigrants, just as one example, kept coming in large numbers all the way up into World War I. And they didn't have more land. And so there were two motivations for this, this act. One was to the Native peoples put on these reservations no longer had the capacity to live and sustain themselves in the ways that they traditionally had. It was impossible. And they were promised government allotments, food and money, in the treaties, but these were often not given. They were used punitively, either to force the Native peoples into making a worse treaty that made them give up what they'd been promised in a prior treaty, or just to punish them outright. And so one motivation was, the only way that Native peoples are going to survive is if they learn how to live differently, if they learn how to be civilized, American, like if they learn how to be farmers. And the way to do that is to give them their own section of land, give each Native person their own 160 acres. But here's the subtle and insidious trick in that. They gave the reservation land to the tribe. So the whole reservation was communally owned by the tribe. And as soon as they started giving sections of land to each Native person, all of a sudden there was all this unassigned land on the reservation. And they surveyed the reservations into these quarter sections, 160 acres, and all of a sudden they could start giving white settlers land on the reservations. So this is from Karen Hance's book, which is about the Devil's Lake Reservation in North Dakota, and her Norwegian ancestors who came and homesteaded a section of land on the Spirit Lake Reservation and lived side by side with the Dakota people whose reservation it was. And this is her quote. And here's a description of the motivation from the time. From a so-called progressive organization at the time that was advocating for a better life, they thought, for Native people. The Indians must be taught industry and acquisitiveness to fit him for his ultimate absorption into the great body of American citizenship. Friends of the Indian, that was the organization's name. Here's the location of the Spirit Lake Reservation, sort of central, north central, eastern North Dakota. A picture of the outline of the reservation land on the south side of Devil's Lake. And this was one of the Dakota reservations that when after the 1862 Dakota-U.S. War, the Governor Ramsey issued an executive order in Minnesota that all Dakota should be killed expelled from the state. Many of those former Minnesotan Dakota people were moved to this and other reservations in the Dakotas. So that's why this particular band of Dakota were on this land. And here's a map of an official U.S. government map of the reservation turned into sections. And on the original map, they're all red, but all the black ones are available. So that shows you how much of the reservation was available for white settlers after they assigned a section to each of the Native people on the reservation. And then here's an ad that they used for these to attract people to come west for this.
At the Smithsonian in Washington, I had a lecture. They said that the 160 acres, the Indians were not eligible because they were not considered civilized. You had to have to be a civilized person. And even though some of them were Christians, because they were Indians, they were denied land because they were not considered a civilized person.
That was true from the Homestead Act up to this point. And after the Dawes Act, they were given, each Native person on a reservation was given, if they were an adult male, they were given 160 acres. Women and children were given 80 acres. And so that shifted at this particular point. And that's why the passage of this act marks this shift in U.S. policy toward Native peoples to try and culturally destroy them rather than just, they hadn't succeeded in literally destroying all of the Native peoples. And so then this became an effort, I mean, on a couple of levels, right? If they had a section of land and were expected to own that, then they're shifting their whole orientation to land. And the invitation, the implication of that was you should make your living off your property. And so that, and farming is a way to do that. And so the intention was to, quote, civilize them in the same way that white people were. And then this idea of having white settlers interspersed with the Native people gives this kind of cross-fertilization, which they thought would also lead to the kind of civilizing of the Native peoples. And then after this, there's a whole set of things which followed in this trajectory of cultural assimilation, including the whole history of the boarding schools and the way that Native children were taken away and de-Indianized, and many of them killed themselves. I mean, it's just a horrific story. And the church ran those. Christian church ran those boarding schools. It's a horror. It's not the story that we're dealing with today, but it followed from where the Laura Ingalls Wilder stories end in terms of the Native story. Someone over here? Oh, yeah. Yeah, please.
So I've got two questions.
Yes.
First, with the Dawes Act, when they ended up splitting up those 160-acre sections, was it the government that did that?
Yeah.
Or were the Indians allowed to choose, like, their, the piece of land they wanted from their location?
No, the government did it through the government Indian agents.
Okay, so yeah. It was like, so was there any, do you know of any problems with that where they kind of saved the choice land for the new white settlers that would come?
I don't know enough about the details of how it worked itself out to know that.
Gotcha.
I mean, every time I do know of where that happened, as I'm sure you are aware, that is what happened. But in terms of this specific act and the way it split up land on reservation land, I don't know how they made decisions about who got what land. Okay. The order of it was they divided up and gave all the existing native residents on the reservation land and then opened up all the leftover land to white settlers. Gotcha. So in terms of order of the process, the native peoples got particular land first, but I don't know who decided which piece of land they got.
And then I had another question with how was it different with the tribes that were kind of in the Midwest and North versus in the Southwest, New Mexico, Arizona?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting opportunities I have in this process is just being completely ignorant about a lot of important facts in the story. And so I don't really know that much about what happened in the Southwest. And even when it happened, how the Homestead Act applied to what happened in the Southwest. So I don't know if other people know, this interesting question, what happened in other parts of the country with the...
Isn't the Dawes Act for the whole country?
I think so, but I think it's in its particular intention, it was focused on the... where the settlers were really going at the time, which was all these Midwestern states where they could have the vision of farming. And I don't think that was the same in the Southwest. But that's just my guess. I don't really know for sure. Yeah, please.
Chris, could you say some more about how that 160 acres, that kind of ideology of Jeffersonian agrarian populism had racialized origins as well, or becomes racialized through?
Well, in the first instance, it's racialized because in an interesting way because it was a part of the argument against the South and against the system of plantations that use slave labor. So it was a particular vision of white voting males who earned a living off their own land. It's a particular story about what it is to be American. And that got, that was a part of the vision for the Homestead Act. And the Homestead Act wasn't passed for about 20 years in Congress because the Southern members of Congress felt the rebuke of that, of their way of farming. And so they stalled it. And it wasn't until the Civil War and all the upheaval that brought in the political system that the Homestead Act could be passed.
Do you know of any evidence of African American soldiers fighting for the North?
In Arizona.
Receiving land.
In 1867, there was an addendum to the Homestead Act that allowed for African American participation in the Homestead Act. But there was so much local opposition to that it was very often not allowed.
Thanks.
But in that immediate post-war, if you think about the Civil War ending and Reconstruction, that early part of Reconstruction, there was a lot of really progressive things that happened. And one of the things that happened was in 1867, an addendum allowing for African Americans to use the Homestead Act for land. And in fact, if you look, when the Ingalls family were in Kansas, and you look at they say that no one was there except for them, but there were 12,000 to 15,000 settlers on the Osage Diminished Reserve. And the census in 1870 that came through cataloged all the people who were in their section of the land. And there was an African-American squatter on a piece of land there. So it's evidence from the census that, that there were some African Americans coming west and trying to take advantage of the possibility of settling. And now, so 1867, that addendum was made, and this was 1870 in Kansas. So it was happening, but it obviously had all the difficulties you would expect.
I just wanted to invite those of you who find your way to Arizona anytime in the next while to go to the Heard Museum, where there's an extraordinary exhibit about the boarding schools. If you can make it through there and still have your stomach, you're a better person than I.
Can you tell the time frame for the boarding schools? Because I don't even know what that is.
I think the first half of the 20th century, and in Canada they even operated up into the 60s. The same kind of thing happened both in the U.S. and Canada.
And Australia. Yep.
And Australia. One more comment, and then we'll close. Go ahead, Peg.
Well, I was just going to say, from my experience of being a community leader, you didn't have to move any white settlers into that area to break up that community.
Right.
It's actually genius, and it's still being used today.
It's a dividing mechanism.
It's being used today all over the planet to divide communities, to make them less strong and less ability to fight whatever institution is trying to exert their will within them.
Thanks for that. This is a last comment that I'll close with. The Osage tribe, who were on the land that the Ingalls tried to settle on in Kansas, were signed a treaty and moved to Oklahoma, which is where they remained. And they did not, for whatever reason, they resisted the Dawes Act and kept their land communally owned. And then later, lo and behold, on their, quote, terrible land that they were given, oil was discovered.
And they bought their land.
And they bought their land. That's right. The government gave them money for the land in Kansas, and they bought the land, so they owned it communally, and including the mineral rights in Oklahoma, and they put the remainder of the money they didn't need in the bank, and then oil was discovered. So the Osage tribe actually had a very different story than many of the tribes for whom, and it was partly decisions they made proactively, really communally powerful decisions they made on their own behalf, and then this development of oil on their land. So they weren't divided in quite the same way. All right, thanks for coming.
This was great.